Romans 9:30-10:21. The 14th talk in a series on Romans was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 25, 2005, at McKinsey Study Center and Institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Last week we looked at the first part of the argument in Romans where he has left his responding to the first objection that a typical Pharisee might have to the gospel, and he started to discuss a second objection that a Pharisee might have to the gospel, and that objection is, Paul, if your gospel is right, then everything that God promised the Jews of old is nonsense, is not being fulfilled by God. So he has three chapters where he responds to that objection in a variety of different ways. Last week, the argument went, you don't seem to understand what has happened in the scriptures. God never promised every child of Israel that they would necessarily be recipients of the blessing of Abraham. Just as in the case of Abraham's children, and then after that Isaac's children, it wasn't each of their children that was a child of promise. It was only one of their children that was a child of promise. When we get to Israel, why would we assume that every child of Israel is a child of promise? And so Paul is showing how fallacious their reasoning is when they simply presume that because they are children of Israel, they will therefore be children of promise and will receive the promise of Abraham. Then he responds to the objection, but that's not fair. God shouldn't take one child of Israel and not offer the same blessing to every child of Israel. And he argues that if we go back into the Old Testament, we find that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God that we all recognize from the Old Testament, if we grant that that God is a righteous God, that righteous God in the Old Testament has made it abundantly clear that he intends to discriminate between individuals. Not everyone is automatically going to receive mercy. He will show mercy to whom he chooses to show mercy. And that then raises the question, well, how can he blame people if he's the one who's determining whether he's going to show mercy to them or not? No one can resist God. No one can resist his purposes and his will. So if we are forced by the will of God to be people who have our hearts hardened against him, he can't hold us accountable, can he? To which he responds by saying, yes, he can. With what is really kind of an argument, although it's an argument that comes in the form of an analogy, a metaphor, and unfortunately, Paul doesn't really unpack it as well as we would like. So I've tried to do that for him in the book that I wrote. And then he ends that section by pointing out that God's purpose all along has been to take out from among both Jews and Gentiles a people that will be his people, the children of God, the people of God. But he's culling out from among what he calls vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. He's culling out from among them vessels of mercy prepared for glory. And the reason God has not come and smashed the vessels of wrath already is not because they're not worthy of condemnation. It's not because they're not worthy of destruction. It's because God is patiently waiting for all those people whom he's going to call to himself to come into existence over the course of history and over the course of time, both from among the Jews and among the Gentiles. And that's pretty much where we left off last time. So now we get to section 19, and we'll take it a paragraph at a time here. So what are we saying? That the Gentile nations who are not pursuing dikaiosune have obtained dikaiosune, even the dikaiosune that is by virtue of belief. But Israel, while pursuing dikaiosune according to a covenant that could lead to dikaiosune, did not attain it within that covenant. Now, if you're new here, remember that, or if you are not new, I'll remind you, if you're new here, let me explain what Dikayasune is. Dikayasune is basically being in a position where God is going to accept you into the kingdom of God, accept you, grant you eternal life at the judgment seat. That's the condition that we need to be in if we are going to live rather than die, if we're going to be blessed rather than condemned at the judgment seat. So the question is, who attains to that Dikayasune? So he's simply summarizing his conclusion here. What I'm saying is, the Gentiles, by having come to believe in the gospel, have attained it, have attained Dikayasune. Israel, who is in the best position to attain it, because they had the greater revelation, they had the greater information to go on, that would have led to Dikayasune, but they who are in the best position to attain it are missing out on it by virtue of their not believing in the gospel. So he simply in 79 is just laying out the lay of the land as he's come to understand it in his time. Okay, now he goes on in 80 to explain why. Why is it that Israel has missed out and the Gentiles have received it or attained to it? Why? Because they did not pursue Dikayasune, that's Israel, because they did not pursue Dikayasune by believing. Rather, they pursued it as if it were by works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. As it is written, "Look, I am placing in Zion a stumbling stone, even a rock that harms, but anyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about. Brothers, the desire of my heart and my petition on their behalf is for their salvation. I would vouch for them that they have a zeal for God, but it is not in accordance with knowledge. Being ignorant of the Dikayasune purposed by God and seeking to establish their own, they have not made themselves subject to the Dikayasune purposed by God." Okay. To understand what he's saying here, the point that he's making is simple. They have sought to establish Dikayasune from God on their own terms, on terms that they themselves have invented and created and devised, rather than submitting to the terms that God himself has placed on Dikayasune. We'll talk more about that in a second. But that's fundamentally what this paragraph is saying. But in the process, he draws an analogy and quotes a passage out of Isaiah. I want to spend a little time there so that we can understand exactly what it is that he's saying. Let me set the groundwork for this. This is in Isaiah chapter 28, for those if you have a Bible and want to turn there. Let me set the groundwork. If you remember, after Solomon, the kingdom that had been established by the Jews in Palestine got split into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Southern kingdom was called Judah. Northern kingdom maintained the name Israel. As time went on, over in the Mesopotamian area, a city-state called Assyria began to grow in power and military might. And they got greedy and ambitious and ruthless and cruel and were out to conquer the world. That's the geopolitical explanation. The divine explanation for what happened is God was raising up the people that he was going to use to judge his people who were being disobedient. They had never, from the time of Moses on, they had never given their hearts to God. They had never really wanted to keep the covenant. They never really did keep the covenant. And even when they outwardly tried to keep some aspects of the covenant, they never really people who loved their Creator, God, nor sought to know Him and honor Him. That had just never happened in their time. And God had all kinds of things against them in terms of their transgression and their disobedience and their disregard for Him. So, after many warnings by many prophets, it's finally time to bring in Assyria to judge them. And Isaiah is right a few decades before that, and he's prophesying to Judah at this point. But he's describing how they're going to come in and completely wipe out and annihilate the northern kingdom, Assyria. They're going to be gone because of the Assyrian invasion. And they're going to come right up to the neck, is the language that's used, of Judah. but they're going to pass through, and Judah's going to survive, but not without being completely and totally devastated in the process. That's what Isaiah has been describing when we come to this passage. This is in Isaiah 28. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by, for we have made falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters will overflow the secret place. Your covenant with death will be canceled, and your pact with Sheol will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, then you become its trampling place. As often as it passes through, it will seize you, for morning after morning it will pass through, any time during the day or night, and it will be sheer terror to understand what it means. The bed is too short on which to stretch out, and the blanket is too small to wrap oneself in. For the Lord will rise up as at Mount Perazim. He will be stirred up as in the valley of Gibeon to do his task, his unusual task, and to work his work, his exemplary work, his extraordinary work. And now do not carry on as scoffers, or your fetters will be made stronger. For I have heard from the Lord God of hosts of decisive destruction on all the earth. It's one verse out of this passage that Paul is quoting in Romans that he wants to make an analogy with the Phariseeism of his day. So I think what we need to do is to understand this in context. Going back to Romans for just a second, just so you can see the different approach I'm going to be taking to this than some commentators. Many commentators, in looking at paragraph 80 here, rather they pursued it as if it were by works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. There, you will probably find many teachers and commentators that will see the stumbling stone as Jesus. Maybe there's a sense in which the stumbling stone is Jesus. We'll talk about that in a second. But that's not fundamentally the right way to approach how Paul is understanding the Old Testament. Isaiah is speaking to a group of people in a way that ought to be meaningful to them. I mean, if they don't understand it, it's because they're blind and they don't want to know and they don't want to listen and they're not paying attention. But it's not because his language is so completely mysterious and incomprehensible that it couldn't possibly be understood. So as interpreters of the Old Testament, we need to go back and put ourselves in that time and place, knowing what they know, understanding what they understand, and hear the prophet's language in those terms from that standpoint. If we don't, I don't think we are rightly understanding the Old Testament. I think it's fair to say that when Isaiah says this to Judah, there's no way in the world that they look at the cornerstone that's being laid and say, oh, I see, there's going to be a Galilean peasant several thousand years from now who's going to die on the cross and he's going to claim to be the Messiah and we need to believe that. I mean, that can't be. That's not right. And I don't believe Paul is in any way suggesting that they should have understood it that way. Well, if not that way, how? What are we to understand? The rulers of Judah feel safe, secure, and protected because they have made alliances with the king of Aram, the king of Syria, other kings in the vicinity. They've made these military alliances, and to the extent that they feel safe at all, they feel like their safety rests in these military alliances that they have forged. They are going to secure their place in the land. If God's promises are going to be fulfilled, then it's going to be due to them protecting themselves in the land through their devices, in effect. Well, God, through Isaiah, is saying to them, I'm going to cancel your alliances, these pacts that you've made, these covenants that you've made. They're going to be totally worthless to you. The terror is going to come and destroy you and terrorize you in spite of all of these pacts that you have. In the context, that's primarily what he wants to say. But in the context of saying that, he says, therefore says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed, or as I translated it, will have nothing to fret about, something like that. What is he saying? What Paul recognizes here is this would be a very unusual person back in Judah who could believe in the promise of God that God was about to start building something in Zion. And they could place their hope in that. And by placing their hope in that, they would live. Well, what is it he's building? First of all, I think this is a metaphor, not a literal reality. Obviously, he's not literally laying a cornerstone. But metaphorically, what he's saying is, I'm burying my arms. I'm getting ready to start building. I'm getting my measuring line and my level out. Even right now, today, I'm committed to building something. And I think what he's referring to is basically that kingdom that he had promised Abraham thousands of years earlier. So the issue for you, as you see the Assyrians come, about to ravage your land and to destroy everything that you've worked for and to take some of you captive and take you away, that the thing that you have to, what I'm asking of you is that you recognize the promises that I made to Abraham, I'm going to keep. Even though outwardly it looks like you're being defeated, outwardly it looks like hope is being lost, outwardly it looks like God's promises are being precluded from ever being realized, I'm telling you, I'm beginning, yea, even now, to start the process to establish the kingdom that I promised that I would establish. And notice that he talks about his measuring line is righteousness or justice, and his level is righteousness. I think that's a metaphorical way of saying, what I promised you is that I would be your God and you would be my people, and I will reign over you in righteousness, and you will be a righteous people in that day. Well, that's the project that he ultimately wants to build, if you will. And he's saying, well, I've got my level, I've got my measuring line, and I'm laying the foundation even now. Believe it. Place your hope in that. Now, put yourself in the shoes of somebody in Judah that day. It's going to take a remarkably far-sighted person to respond to that by saying, yes, I will believe in that and I will find hope in that. Because what's your life going to look like? What your life is going to look like is your vineyard is going to be trashed, your house might be torn down, your cistern might be filled with rocks. Your life is going to be made miserable by this invading army that's coming to you and is going to wreck your land and destroy your land. Some of your family may lose their life. You know, there's really not much hope in this world for you here and now that Isaiah has to offer you, or that God has to offer you, because he says the Assyrians are coming to destroy you. But good news, God hasn't forgotten his promise. The kingdom that he said he's going to build, he's going to build. So believe in that and hope in that. You have to have an entirely different set of values to allow your whole life here in the present age to be completely destroyed and turned on its head and still find hope that God is going to do what God said he's going to do, and he's going to run history according to his righteousness, and to think that that's a good thing. Part of what that entails is a recognition that the Assyrians coming is ultimately a good thing, because we, the people of Israel, have been disobedient. We, the people of Israel, have not kept the covenant. We, the people of Israel, deserve to be judged. And as much as it's going to be uncomfortable and not much fun for me, it is a right and good thing that God send the Assyrians in judgment. I mean, that's going to have to be part of the perspective that such a person would take. Well, it's to that's what Paul is quoting, except that he tweaks it a little bit, if you noticed. He says, they stumble over the stumbling stone, as it is written, look, I am placing in Zion a stumbling stone. Well, that's not what Isaiah 28 says. It says a costly cornerstone or a precious cornerstone, something like that. He says, even a rock that harms, but anyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about. So he quotes Isaiah 28, but he uses something earlier out of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 8, and substitutes it for the cornerstone and calls it a stumbling stone. In Isaiah 8, God says, I'm going to be a stumbling stone to the house of Judah. Well, that's what he substitutes here. The very thing that we are to believe in, we stumble over in our unbelief. If we do not believe, then we stumble over. And stumbling, whenever the New Testament authors use stumbling, they're not talking about being lacking grace as you sort of trip over the edge of the carpet. They're talking about tripping over a rock that sends you hurtling down a 1,000-foot cliff to your destruction, kind of stumbling. That's what they're talking about. Okay, what is he talking about here? What have the Pharisees done? The Pharisees, very much like the rulers in Judah, when faced with the question of, are God's promises going to be secure for us? Are we going to get the blessing that God secured for us? They see their task as to secure it for themselves in the same way that Judah saw securing the land as their responsibility. We need to make some alliances so that we can secure the land for ourselves and protect ourselves in it and make sure we don't lose it. Similarly, the Pharisees, when faced with the possibility of the eternal life, the blessing of Abraham, they saw it as their responsibility to make sure that they secured that for themselves. How? Because they, as he puts it, rather they pursued it as if it were by works. And we've talked about this before. They saw their task as demonstrating themselves worthy to receive the blessing by their conformity to the law of Moses, to the statutes and ordinances and judgments in the covenant with Moses. It was their job to conform their life to that, and most importantly, in conforming their life to those ordinances, to demonstrate themselves as worthy. It was not about trusting in the grace of God. It was not about trusting in the mercy of God. It was not about trusting in the purposes of God or anything like that. It was me demonstrating myself worthy and therefore securing for myself this blessing. Similarly, unlike the believer who would have to respond to God's instructions here to believe in it, by recognizing that the Assyrians' coming was not a threat to what God wanted to accomplish for them, but it was simply God's judgment of sin. The Pharisees saw the acknowledgement or the recognition, the awareness of their own sinfulness as a threat to God's purposes in their life. And I mean, that's something we all face as well. We are trained in Christian culture, I think, to see a confession of our sinfulness, a recognition, an honest recognition of our own moral failure as somehow putting my life in jeopardy. How will God bless me if I'm a sinner? How will God bless me if I'm disobedient? How will God bless me if I'm morally broken and weak? I must demonstrate that I'm dedicated, that I'm committed, that I'm loyal, that I'm an obedient follower of Jesus so that he can bless me and so that he will bless me. What God had told the people in Judah is, this is judgment. Recognize that this judgment is deserved. Recognize that this judgment ought to be coming. My purposes will stand. I am not forsaking you. I am not reneging on my covenants and my promises. Believe me, I'm going to work on it right now. I'm going to establish the kingdom I said I'm going to establish. Just trust me. Just hope in me. Place your hope in me. That's exactly how the gospel is as over compared to Phariseeism. The gospel that Paul teaches is you are undeserving, you're deserving of condemnation, you're deserving of judgment, your sin needs to be punished, but my promises still stand. Just trust me. Believe that I'm going to give you what I said I will give you. Believe that I will act toward you in mercy. Believe that I will act toward you in grace. So, that's in effect what Paul is doing in this passage. So why? Because they did not pursue the kaiosune by believing in the mercy and the grace of God and the promises of God. Rather, they pursued it as if it were by works, they stumbled over the stumbling stone. As it is written, look, I am placing in Zion a stumbling stone, even a rock that harms, but anyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about. Okay, then he goes on, brothers, the desire of my heart and my petition on their behalf is for their salvation. I would vouch for them that they have a zeal for God, but it is not in accordance with knowledge. Being ignorant of the dikaiosune purposed by God and seeking to establish their own, they have not made themselves subject to the dikaiosune purposed by God. And very simply, what's the difference? The dikaiosune that they set up and tried to establish on their own was a dikaiosune that results from me demonstrating that I am worthy. The dikaiosune purposed by God was to have his son, the Messiah, die on the cross, appealing to God, the judge, as our high priest for mercy, and for God to grant us grace and mercy simply and for no other reason than the high priest has appealed to mercy for us, and God grants it. Those are the two options. The second was taught by the Apostle Paul. The first was what the mindset and the teaching of the Pharisees were in his day. And he's saying they were ignorant of the dikaiosune that God purposed, and seeking to establish their own, they didn't submit to the dikaiosune that was purposed by God. Okay, he goes on then in 81. Now the Christ was the culmination of the covenant, resulting in dikaiosune for all who believe, for all those who believe. Moses does indeed write of a dikaiosune, that is, by virtue of the covenant. The man who does these things shall live by these things. He's quoting, I think it's Deuteronomy. But this dikaiosune is by virtue of belief. Okay, let me stop there. Very, very interesting point, and for me, a very revolutionary point. For many years as a Bible teacher, the perspective that I had been taught and that made sense to me is that the way to understand the Mosaic covenant is that the Mosaic Covenant was a kind of cosmic joke, an educational and pedagogical joke, but a joke nonetheless. Because in the Mosaic Covenant, God was coming along and saying, now, here's the deal. If you'll be really, really good and godly people, I will bless you and grant you life. Don't be good and godly people, and I will curse you and you will die. The reason that's a joke, however, as I understood it, was we are morally depraved people. There's no way in the world I can be good and godly, at least not to the degree and measure up to the standard of the law. And God knew that, so he's having to be chuckling a little bit under his breath as he makes this deal, because it's such an impossible law to keep. Now, I didn't see it as being, I never saw it as simply being cruel on God's part. It was intended by God to rub my nose in the reality of my own sinfulness, to rub my nose in the stink of my own moral degradation, in order that I would come to understand that and know that. There's some truth to that. I mean, that is a role that the law does play, and I think that's a role that Paul acknowledges that the law plays, but that's not all there is to the law, and that's not primarily what the law is all about. What Paul is, and Paul is explicitly contradicting that in this passage, because what he says here is, Moses does indeed write of a dikaiosune that is by virtue of the covenant. So what he's saying is, Moses recognized that a person could attain dikaiosune through the law. He knew that. He said so. Do this and you will live, he quotes. Okay, well, what does he have in mind? We may have talked about this briefly before, but let me review it. What Paul recognizes is you can keep, even if you can't be godly and good, you can nonetheless take the covenant seriously. You can take it on. In the process of taking on the law of Moses, you will evidence your ungodliness. You will have evil desires and you will have evil thoughts and you will do evil things toward other people. And what does the law say to do when you do that? Well, there are sin offerings, and there's guilt offerings, and there's the Day of Atonement. There's all kinds of provision in the law for responding to the reality of your moral brokenness. The law recognizes that. But God was never requiring us, or the Jews, to be perfect. He was never requiring us to have the moral perfection that he himself has. All he was requiring is that we take him, God, seriously, and therefore take his covenant seriously. And to use the language of Deuteronomy, to keep it. But when Moses talks about keeping the law or keeping the covenant, he doesn't mean performing to a level of moral perfection. What he means is authentically striving to honor the God of that covenant, my Creator, by taking the covenant seriously. So if I do fail, I offer the offerings, because that's what the covenant says to do. So to make a sober and serious attempt to honor God in the doing of it. That's what Moses has in mind when he says, the man who does these things shall live by these things. What I didn't understand for years is what it means to do these things. You know, Leviticus says, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, what if I don't really quite rise to that level? Have I not done these things then? No, I don't think Moses would say I have not done these things. Because who can love his neighbor like himself, as himself? Who can do that? Who can rise to that level of moral perfection? But you can be the kind of person who sees how right it would be to love your neighbor as yourself, who does everything I can to battle against selfishness and battle against that egocentrism that prevents me from loving my neighbor as myself. I wage war with all the contrary impulses, and when I fail, I call it a failure. I recognize that it's a failure, and in recognizing it's a failure, I go to the temple with my sin offering or my guilt offering or whatever the law has prescribed. When you look at the entire picture of that person's life, Moses would look at that person and say, they have done these things. Even though I have morally failed, I haven't failed to keep the covenant. And Paul is recognizing that even in Old Testament terms, such a person would be justified in God's eyes, would stand to live rather than die. Well, that's what he's getting at as he goes on in this paragraph then. This is one of the weirdest passages in the New Testament if you don't understand what he's doing. He, Moses, writes thus, do not say in your heart, who will ascend up into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. Rather, what does he say, Moses say? What is required is near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart. This is the requirement that consists of the belief that we proclaim. For if you proclaim with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes, resulting in dikaiosune, and with the mouth one confesses, resulting in salvation. What's so weird is Paul is taking a passage that has nothing to do with Jesus whatsoever and is applying it to this situation of whether or not you believe in Jesus. So let me see if I can explain what I think he's doing. The passage he's talking about is out of Deuteronomy, I think it's 30. Deuteronomy 30. Let me read it for you. Moreover, the Lord your God, this is Moses is kind of giving his last sermon to Israel before they go into the promised land, and he's giving them a little history in advance, prophesying what their history is going to be. Moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants. This is looking way in the future, what Moses is describing here, I would argue, has not even happened to this day yet. Moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul so that you may live. The Lord your God will inflict all these curses on your enemies and on those who hate you, who persecuted you. And you shall again obey the Lord and observe all his commandments which I command you today. Then the Lord your God will prosper you abundantly in all the work of your hand, in the offspring of your body and in the offspring of your cattle and in the produce of your ground. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good, just as he rejoiced over your fathers, if you obey the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and soul. Now, this is right at the end of his little history lesson. Then he enters into this next section that's sort of commenting on everything he said in the sermon. Now, this commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us to get it for us and make us hear it that we may observe it. Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea for us to get it for us and make us hear it that we may observe it. But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it. Okay, what is he saying? He's looking back on, if we had read the whole book of Deuteronomy, there's a lot of details in Deuteronomy. There are things that you can eat, and there's things that you can't eat. There's ways to wear your clothes and ways not to wear your clothes. There's funny little religious objects that you're supposed to put on your part of your clothing. There's days that you can work and days that you can't work. There's things you can eat and things you can't eat. Did I already say that? I mean, there's all these particulars. And this is coming at them in one fairly lengthy sermon that interspersed within the sermon are all these requirements that God is requiring of Israel. And he's saying of them, you keep these statutes and judgments and ordinances that I'm giving today, and I will take you in the land and you will prosper. Don't do these things, and the land will vomit you out, and I will curse you. Well, you know, if you take that seriously, it could be a little overwhelming. And Moses recognizes how overwhelming it could be to think that you've just unloaded this boatload of ordinances and judgments and statutes and stuff, and you're saying, keep them all. Well, help me. I mean, did anyone take notes? I mean, does anyone know what all these consist of, and how are we going to keep all these details? And his response to that is, look, it's not that hard. It's really not that hard. This commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach, such that you should say, well, somebody help. Somebody send somebody up to heaven and bring them down and help us hear these same things so that we can observe them. Or send somebody across the sea and bring them back to that we might hear him and observe them. What he says is, but the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it. Well, notice what he said just before this section. If you obey the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in the book of the law, if you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and soul. I think what Moses is saying is, now look, you guys, it's not that hard. I know there's a whole lot of details in here that I've laid on you. But the bottom line is that all is asking of you is that you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul. If you do that, the particulars and the details are of little consequence to God. If you accidentally eat an ossifrage because you don't know what an ossifrage is, God is not going to strike you dead because you accidentally ate an ossifrage. God is not going to strike you dead if you forgot one of those items of clothing that he said that you were supposed to do. If you accidentally cut the corner of your beard, relax. God can get over it. It's going to be okay. He's not asking you to do these things because he's obsessed with religious symbols, with relatively small, trivial, detailed religious symbols. It's not his obsession with those things that's made him command you these things. All he wants is for you to take him seriously. And that's in your mouth and in your heart. It's only an existential decision away. It's only an act of repentance away that you be what God wants you to be here. The details are relatively unimportant. So don't tense up. Don't be overwhelmed by the amount of details that I've laid on you today. Well, in that context then, notice how that plays with what he said here. Moses does indeed write of a dikaiosune that is by virtue of the covenant. The man who does these things shall live by these things. But this dikaiosune is by virtue of belief. The Pharisees had said that the dikaiosune that Moses talks about is by virtue of works. That is, what God is asking of you is that you conform your life completely to every little jot and tittle of the law, and that if you conform your life to every little jot and tittle of the law, God will bless you, and God will grant you the blessing. But Paul is saying, no, that's not what Moses was saying. He wasn't saying if you successfully conformed every jot and tittle of the law. What Moses had in mind is that you turn and give God your heart and your soul. That's what Moses thought. And by doing that, you would be keeping the law. That's what he says, but this dikaiosune is by virtue of belief. That is, the person who believes that God is there, that he's the God of the covenant, that the covenant he's made with you is worthwhile and it's worth investing in, that you believe those things are true. That's the person who's going to be reckoned as dikaios in God's eyes. So when he comes to this quote by Moses, he takes the spirit of what Moses was saying and transposes it out of their context into the Pharisees' context. What Moses is saying, what would it look like in your context, Pharisees? Moses writes thus, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down. The Pharisees saw this peasant from Galilee, Jesus, hung on the cross by the Romans, and they saw it as a confirmation that he wasn't the Messiah. They didn't get it. They didn't know God. They didn't love God. And so when God acted in history, they didn't recognize it as God acting in history. So if your heart and soul were given to God, if you had turned your heart and soul toward God, then you wouldn't be asking for someone to send the Messiah, because you would recognize in Jesus that the Messiah has already come. Or do not say, who will ascend into the abyss, that is to bring the Christ up from the dead. You would be recognizing that Jesus was raised from the dead, that he didn't stay dead precisely because he was the Christ. You would be acknowledging that and would be seeing in Jesus the hand of God and the work of God. But you don't see it, and therefore you're not practicing the belief that Moses was advocating to Israel back in Deuteronomy. Rather, what does Moses say? What is required? If you have another translation, it'll say the word is near you. The Greek word rhema is often used in a sense that just means a thing. And I would take it as the thing here. The thing is near you. The thing is in your mouth and in your heart. Well, what's the thing he's talking about? In the context of Deuteronomy, it's that which is required of you by God is near you. It's in your mouth. It's in your heart. This is the requirement that consists of the belief that we proclaim. That is, what is God requiring of us today? Paul is saying that we believe the gospel. That's what he's requiring, that we believe that Jesus is the Messiah, that we believe that Jesus came to save us from our sins and so on. That's what God requires. For if you proclaim with your mouth Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised from the dead, you will be saved. For with the mouth one believes, resulting in dikaiosune. Sorry, with the heart one believes, resulting in dikaiosune, and with the mouth one confesses, resulting in salvation. Recognize what Paul is doing here. And when he says with the heart one believes and with the mouth one confesses, he's not making any sort of comment about the right ritual for making sure you get saved. Make sure you don't believe with your mouth and confess with your heart, because that's backwards and that won't get you eternal life. I mean, he's not saying that. He's simply making a rhetorical connection with the Deuteronomy account, what Moses is saying, and trying to draw a parallel there using kind of a poetic rhetorical device. But he doesn't mean that literally. Okay, pressing on then to section 20. Now he goes on to point out that the means of dikaiosune that the Gentiles have attained and the Jews have missed out on, the Jews of Paul's day have missed out on, is universal. It's absolutely the same way to dikaiosune for everybody, Jew and Gentile. So in 82 he says, now the scripture is saying that everyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about. He's quoting the same Isaiah passage that he did earlier with reference to the stumbling stone. Everyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about, for there is no distinction between the Jew and the Greek, for the same one is Lord over all men, abounding in riches for all those who call upon him, Indeed, everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And yet, how can they call upon one in whom they have not believed? Okay, this is a subtle argument here. Notice that he says, everyone who believes in it will have nothing to fret about, but that's not how Isaiah read. He has added the everyone. There's the word all in the Greek text here that is not in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of Isaiah, nor is it in the Hebrew Masoretic text of Isaiah. He's adding that all here. The same thing with, So where does he get the all? Later then he says in 3, indeed everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved, out of Joel, the minor prophet Joel. That text does have the everyone. But the problem with that text is it doesn't say everyone who believes will be saved. It says everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. So in order to make the point that he wants to make, that everyone who believes will be justified, he then adds the rhetorical question, and yet how can they call upon one in whom they have not believed? So I think the point that he's making is, I grant you, Joel doesn't say everyone who believes will be saved. He says everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. But how are you going to be calling upon the name of the Lord if you haven't believed? So he's saying Joel is tantamount to saying everyone who believes will be saved. But the problem with Joel is, and I'll leave it, we're running out of time, so I'll leave it to you to go look at it if you want. But the context of Joel is the nation of Israel in the end times, in our future. This has not happened yet, the thing that Joel is talking about. The time is going to come where everyone in Israel is going to be saved. Now, what's that have to do with Gentiles? It doesn't have anything to do with Gentiles. Joel's not talking about Gentiles. And yet I think the point of this whole paragraph is there is no distinction between the Jew and the Greek, for the same one is Lord over all men, abounding in riches for all those who call upon him. So his argument here is subtle, but I think it's perfectly valid. What he's saying is, when Joel looks into the future and sees this time where there's this sorting out in Israel, there are those who don't believe and they end up being destroyed, and then there are those who believe and are saved. And everyone who believes is saved. That is, everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord is saved. You don't find God going to someone who calls upon his name, sorry, man, you're not on the list. That you simply don't have that kind of phenomenon. So even though the set of people that we're talking about is only Jews in the last time, nonetheless, you see the heart of God. You see the Spirit of God at work, taking to himself in rescue everyone who calls upon him. Well, Paul then is simply extrapolating and saying, is there going to be any human being on the face of the planet who would call upon the name of the Lord and the Lord would not save? Do we seriously think that that could ever happen? It certainly doesn't match the spirit of the God who Joel is describing in the end times. It doesn't seem to match the spirit of what Isaiah is saying. He who believes in it will have nothing to fret about. Well, was that only a promise given to Jews? Or would the same God who made that promise to Jews, would he extend that same promise to Gentiles maybe? And Paul extrapolates on the basis that there's only one creator. And that same creator is the creator of both Jew and Greek. He's the same Lord over all men. So if he made that offer to the Jews, Paul is saying, I'm betting that the same offer is valid for the Gentiles. All you have to do is believe. All you have to do is call upon the name of the Lord, and you will be saved. Okay? Then he goes on in 83 and 84 to talk about the status of Israel of his time. But how can they believe in that which they have not heard? And how can they hear apart from someone proclaiming it? And how can it be proclaimed unless someone is sent? Just as it is written with respect to Israel, how beautiful are the feet of those who proclaim the good news of good things. I think the point of this passage is you have to believe in order to be saved, according to his argument in 82, but how can God have made that a condition on the Jews in Isaiah's time, for example, that they believe if they hadn't heard the message, if they hadn't heard the promise. So surely they had heard the promise, or Isaiah couldn't have said to them, everyone who believes or he who believes will be saved. So they had to have heard. And they couldn't have heard unless someone had proclaimed it, and they couldn't have been proclaimed unless somebody had been sent to them. What he has in mind is all the prophets that were sent to Israel, I think, to proclaim this stuff to them. He's basically saying, Israel, you have not been ignorant. You have known what God's purposes are and what his promises are. They have been proclaimed to you. He doesn't say it flat out. He just does it through this series of rhetorical questions until you get to 4, and then he says it flat out. Just as it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who proclaim the good news of good things. And that's out of Isaiah. But the problem with Israel is they haven't known what they need to believe. The promise, rather, is what is described in paragraph 84. But not everyone in Israel listened to the good news. Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed our report? So belief is to be from the report, and I think that's what it is literally. I think it should be read, so belief is to follow from the report. That is, belief is the appropriate response to the proclamation that comes from God. It should be responded to with belief. So belief is to be from the report, specifically the report consisting of the word of God. But I say they did not listen, did they? Though it is true, their voice has gone out to the whole earth and their words to the ends of the world. Yet I say that Israel did not understand, did they? So the point that he's making throughout there is in the whole history of Israel, although God has sent his prophets and has sent creation itself screaming at them about the reality of God, the importance of God, and his purposes to be believed and trusted in, Israel has never believed them. And that's been their problem. So then in 85, he takes the opportunity to explain how the Gentiles fit into that relative to the Jews. From the first, Moses says, I will make you jealous by what is not a people. By a people without understanding, I will anger you. This is in Deuteronomy 32. And Isaiah is bold and says, I was found by those who were not seeking me. I became manifest to those who were not inquiring about me. But with regard to Israel, he says, the whole day long I have reached out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. So he contrasts the stubborn, stiff-necked, blind, deaf response of Israel throughout their time with the fact that God, who still has made them his people, and as we go on into the next chapter, this is going to become clearer, these people who are still God's people, God has determined that he's going to make Israel jealous by a people that are not his people, and that's we who are Gentiles. God has poured out his spirit in the world to go out and soften the hearts and open the eyes and minds of Gentiles that we might come to know and understand and believe in the gospel, ultimately to lead to a kind of jealousy of the people of God, because God's ultimate project in this world is to come back to his own people and circumcise their hearts, like we read in Deuteronomy, pour out his spirit upon them, and bring them to a point where all Israel will be saved. We'll see that next week. Okay, so let me stop there, and I'm sure you probably have some questions. So this is not our question. This is not an inherently interesting question that Paul is talking about here, because for those of us who are not Jews in the time of Paul, we don't have the objection that, look, your promises to we Jews has not been fulfilled if your gospel is right. So that's not really a live issue for most of us. But so this is not as personally meaningful to us as something like chapter 8 is. But we deal with it because it's here. And eventually I think this is going to become interesting to all of us, because I think next week will be a little bit more interesting, because we're talking about history or future. He's predicting something, the way history is going to go down. And that's kind of interesting. Okay, questions, sir?
All right. Why do you suppose that the Pharisees, who were people who very seemed to think they were very desperate and being very honest in their attempt to please God and make God happy, why do you suppose they missed God after being so zealous for trying to be God's people, and the sinners and the common dirty people saw it so much quicker?
The common, what'd you call it?
The common dirty people. Do you think it's because they were just dirty and they never tried so hard to be so zealous and so clean? Or what do you think it is that, is it just the Pharisees' absolute love for zeal and they completely miss God altogether? How do you think that works? People who've convinced themselves so strongly that they are holy.
Well, don't mistake his commendation for their zeal as some kind of praise. I don't think he's ultimately praising the Pharisees or the Jews in general in their state of unbelief. He's acknowledging that there is a zeal there, but that zeal is motivated by a kind of self-delusion. I mean, oftentimes religious zeal is very evil at its base and at its root, and I think that's what Paul would say of the Pharisaical zeal. There's nothing really praiseworthy about it in the end, but he has to acknowledge that there's a lot of energy there. I mean, they're taking their religious viewpoint very seriously. It's just that their religious viewpoint is in and of itself completely fallacious and ill-founded. It's founded on self-delusion. Now, you were contrasting the Pharisees with the people of the land, the sinners. Remember that most of the people that followed Jesus left. They didn't stay followers. I mean, even some of those people that were healed by Jesus, I mean, you would think, one would think that if you were healed by Jesus, you of all people would want to be one of his followers and would give your life to him and devote your life to him and so on. But it mostly didn't happen. Because we're quite willing to accept God's gifts to us as long as they don't interfere really with, like, my life. But it's when it starts placing demands on my life that we begin to rethink how we want to be related to this. It's a miracle that any of us are disciples of Jesus. It is just an absolute flat miracle because it goes so much against the grain of the kind of self-centeredness that comes so naturally to us. We just don't want this to be about someone other than me. So I'm not sure that the people of the land, the sinners, were really any more prepared than the Pharisees were. Their sin just manifested itself differently. In Phariseeism, you had institutionalized self-delusion. In the rest of Judaism at that time, you just basically had a flat-out, honest disregard for God, period.
Prefers that more?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they're just both wrong. That's true. There's something more honest about that, but it's a kind of outrageous honesty. You know, God exists and I don't care. I mean, there's something pretty outrageous about that honesty. I don't think there's anything commendable about that. On the other hand, the Pharisee is all about praising and honoring God. And there's something right about that on the one hand, but on the other hand, he's completely self-deluded. God, I thank you that I'm not like all these other people here. You know, they're just complete self-delusion. So I don't know that God has a preference. They're just both perverse ways to be human beings. The Pharisee is probably in the more dangerous position because self-delusion is harder to get out of. It's a kind of a trap. So it may be the more dangerous position, but I'm not sure that it's the more reprehensible position.
I was kind of surprised back in verse 5 of chapter 10, where Paul quotes that Old Testament verse, the one having done them shall live in them. I'm surprised you didn't go over to Galatians 3, where Paul quotes that same verse.
Mm-hmm.
And Galatians 3, 11 says, because in the law, no man is justified before God is evident, because the just out of faith shall live. But the law is not out of faith. but the one having done them shall live in them. But Christ freed us out of the curse of the law, so on and so forth. To me, that verse clearly says that that puts a person in the place of the curse.
Okay.
Because it tells the law, the purpose of the law, as I would understand it, back in Romans 3, is that it puts a man under a perfect knowledge of sin. And that was God's purpose in it.
Right. Well, we'd have to go look at that in Galatians to have an adequate dialogue about that. Paul's view is a little bit more complex, I think. That's how I used to teach it here in Romans and in Galatians. I used to teach it that it was very simple, that here are the requirements, and if we didn't keep them, then we were cursed for our not having kept them, and that's what Jesus was for, is to bring about the remission of sins and redemption because we were under the curse. Well, that's true. We are. That's why Jesus had to die. But that's what I'm arguing is, I think what Paul recognizes is that that's a very, very important function of the covenant and the law, but it's a secondary function and covenant of the law. Let me put it this way. Let's say that I'm a Jew in Israel in the time of Moses, and I as an individual decide to take the law seriously and to take God seriously. What am I going to do? Well, when I find myself not conforming my life to what the law is requiring of me, I'm going to have to go to the temple and offer up some kind of blood sacrifice, usually guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. Well, it can't escape my notice after a while that I'm taking a lot of blood to the temple. I'm frequenting this place. What is the fact that I'm frequenting the temple? What does that say about me? Going to the temple is making me a good Jew. Going to the temple is making me a faithful keeper of the covenant. Going to the temple faithfully, I would say, makes me a keeper of the covenant in a way that makes me justified in God's eyes, I would argue. But all that blood that I'm leaving at the altar at the temple means I'm not a good person. So it's precisely the one who keeps the law who's going to be confronted by the law in such a way that I come to recognize my own moral degradation, my own depravity, my own moral unworthiness in God's eyes. Now, the mistake that the Pharisees made is that they turned all of their outward external observance of the law into moral worthiness. In their minds, keeping the law was something to pat themselves on the back about and go, look what a good boy am I. But a true keeper of the law, who's legitimately keeping the law, could never stand before God and say, God, I'm a good person. All they could do is say, I've kept your law, and your law has shown me what an evil person I am. I don't love my brother. I don't love you, God. I don't honor you. There's just all these ways in which what is embodied in your covenant is a glimpse of righteousness that shames me and dishonors me, reduces me to guilt and shame and humiliation. But it's precisely the one who has sought to keep the law who's going to come to recognize that about himself. And when one recognizes that about himself, all he can do is throw himself on the mercy of God. God, if you're not merciful, I'm dead. So in Galatians, that's the issue directly that he's confronting, because Phariseeism had understood the law to be that which, by doing it, recommended you to God as a worthy person, worthy of the blessing. And that's the thing that he wants to shoot down and he wants to destroy. And that's what he's done earlier in Romans as well. But I think he's doing something different here. And in this context, when he says Moses did indeed write of a dikaiosune, that is, by virtue of the covenant, the question is, what does he have in mind there? We can read it the way the Pharisees did, which is to say, if you keep this law perfectly, then you're worthy of God and you're righteous. But I think Paul would say that's not what Moses meant. That's not how he was looking at it. But that's worthy of a very long discussion, because there's a lot of issues in there.
I'd always heard that part where they talk about how will they know if they haven't heard, as kind of a call to evangelism. Mm-hmm. And then since the next portion, I don't have it right in front of me, goes on to say that the Jews will be made jealous by the Gentiles, in a sense. I'm just wondering, I see your context, but if there's any connection there, too, about Paul as a apostle to the Gentiles.
Well, there certainly will be in the next section. He's going to make that clear that he's magnifying his ministry by converting Gentiles. He's actually accomplishing the purposes of God with respect to the Jews. So he's certainly going to say that explicitly in the next section. What I've called paragraph 83 here is often used as a call to missions. That is, you know, how can they believe if they haven't heard, and how can they hear if no one proclaims it, and how will it ever be proclaimed unless somebody is sent? I mean, in a sense, that's true, but that's not at all what Paul is saying here, I don't think. This is a difficult section to outline. It's a difficult section to follow exactly his thought. But if I'm right in the way I'm understanding it, his whole purpose here is to simply make the case that the Jews have heard. It only stands to reason. How could God, through Isaiah, come to them and say, he who believes in it will be saved, if there wasn't anything that they had heard that they should respond to and believe? And he's just saying, of course God thought that you had heard something. So you're not ignorant. You're not unaware of what it is that you need to be responding to. So you can't use ignorance as an excuse here. And then the last thing he says, I think, is explicit. I say, Israel did not understand, did they? Yes, it was proclaimed to them, but the problem was not that somehow the message didn't get to them. They just didn't hear it. They didn't open their minds and hearts to it such that they took it seriously enough that it was theirs to know and confront. So when we use this as a call to mission, we're ripping it out of its context completely, I think. I mean, I'm all for missions. I think they're wonderful. But what's implicit in using this passage is they usually then couple it with, if you don't go, their blood is on your hands. And that's not Paul's perspective. When he goes out to evangelize and to proclaim the good news, it's because it's a rewarding thing to do, to be a part of God's purposes and bringing other people to himself. But I think Paul is quite confident that God is able to bring his people to himself one way or the other, and he doesn't need me. So I'm not going because God needs me. I'm going because I want to be a part of it. It's a very, very different perspective, I think.
I remember a book a few years ago that said, it was called 12 Steps for the Recovering Pharisee Like Me. And do you think that we all have a tendency to be pharisaical?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. It's the bane of our religious existence. It's the bane of our existence. Most of us as Christians are going to have a sort of natural proclivity to invent our own form of Phariseeism, and we really need to guard against that. And for me, what makes Pharisee, at the heart of Phariseeism, is that self-deception, that not really understanding, not really grasping the reality and the profundity of the evil within me. If I don't get that, then I'm in the same place the Pharisees were. And then I'm going to have a tendency to look at the things that I do for Jesus and Christianity and so on as somehow making me worthy, a worthy person in God's eyes or in my own eyes. And all that means is I don't really see myself very deeply then. Because if I saw myself deeply, I'd recognize that those things don't in any way cancel out or nullify the profound depth of selfishness and pride and greed and perversion that's in me. And our Christian cultures have tended to institutionalize that Phariseeism. And so we create whole cultures that support us and applaud us for superficial expressions of faith. You know, loyalty to the church, loyalty to the institutions of the church, conformity to a certain set of social expectations and calling that obedience or calling that spirituality. I mean, some of the best Christians I know are some of the most deeply perverse people I know. if you understand what I'm saying. That is, by the standards of Christian culture, they may be exalted as wonderful Christians, but as people, they are far from God. Well, that's the result of Phariseeism that has taken that self-delusion and institutionalized and made it the very fabric of the cultures, the Christian cultures that we create, the church cultures we create. We need to always be on our guard against that for that very reason, because that's going to be our tendency, our proclivity, is to create those cultures.
I was curious. He quotes from Psalms 19:4 at the bottom of paragraph 84. And I just, what's the purpose of that in terms of, I think, if I'm remembering right, Psalms 19 talks about like the sun and stars, sort of the proclamation of heaven. And I was curious what your take on, what is his purpose in quoting something like that here?
Well, I think what he's saying is he's contrasting the resistance of Israel to the things of God and the message of God. It not only extended to God's prophets, it extended to creation itself. And then I think that's why he quotes Psalm 19, because Psalm 19 is talking about how the heavens declare the glory of God. That is, even if we didn't have prophets, we'd have the creation itself that if I'm open to the truth about God's creation, I at least know that the Creator is there and He's worthy of my gratitude and respect and honor. I mean, I should know that much. But I think Paul's point is the Jews, Israel, hasn't even given God that much. And they've had a lot more information than that. On top of that, they've had the prophets coming and declaring the specific and particular purposes of God and promises of God on top of that. And not only have they not listened to those specific promises, they haven't even loved the Creator. They haven't even sought to show their gratitude to the Creator as the Creator, let alone Yahweh, the God of their fathers. So I think it's just a way of showing the depth of their resistance to appropriately responding to God.
Phariseeism, you're doing things, and deep down it probably comes from a sense that you're not right. I mean, that's why you're striving so hard. That's why you have so much zeal for doing things, maybe, is that you might be self-deluded, but deep down you know you're not right. And with striving, as I understand how you're talking about it, is you understand you're not right, but you're still trying. And I'm wondering, what is it that you're trying to do that's different? Like, what are you achieving when you strive? What do you strive to do if you're acting out of a conscientiousness that you're sinful?
It seems to me that what Phariseeism does, having lived most of my life as a Pharisee, it seems to me what Phariseeism does is it deludes oneself into thinking that problem is solved. I mean, you're always somehow distancing yourself from that lack. I used to be that way. Before I came to Jesus, I was that way. I mean, you find some way to put your not rightness in a box and settle it. And then you focus on all the things that you're doing that demonstrate that you are right. And so the focus shifts onto the props for your self-delusion, and you manage to distract yourself fairly successfully from that sense of not rightness, which I would distinguish from real, authentic striving, which is very keenly and acutely aware of the not rightness, but doesn't accept that as the last word, as the final word.
What are we doing when we're striving?
Well, what they end up doing almost always are very different. In my experience with Phariseeism, we always focused on relatively superficial lifestyle issues. Do you play cards? Do you dance? Do you smoke? Do you go to movies? Things that, you know, really, when all is said and done, don't take a real profound spirituality to avoid. Just give me enough social advantage to not doing them, and I can not do them. But we don't tend to focus on being just, having integrity, loving my neighbor, living self-sacrificially, living a life for others rather than myself. Those don't tend to be the things that we focus on. It's all these superficial lifestyle issues. And then we we pull off the superficial lifestyle issues and then pat ourselves in the back and say, I'm a good Christian. Whereas a person who's authentically striving against the flesh because he's being tutored by the Spirit is willing to look at himself for what he really is, and he's willing to call my lack of integrity, my selfishness, the failure of justice in my life, and so on, as serious failings, as serious flaws. And when I strive against those things, it's not because I believe I can overcome them. It's not because I believe that, you know, just give me another 10 minutes and I'll be perfect, or another 10 years and I'll be perfect. It's simply because I'm saying a big, resounding no to the sin in my life. I'm not going to accept it. I'm not going to embrace it. It may beat me sometimes, but not because I'm running, not because I'm pulling it to myself. It's because, but it's because it's too strong for me sometimes. I'm too weak, and I get beat by it. But I'm not going to succeed at sin because I've run after sin and got there. If I sin, it's because I've run away from sin and been chased down. So my hope, of course, is for a person like me who said no to my own sin, my hope is the hope of glory. The day is going to come where God will grant me freedom from that sin once and for all. But I have no illusion that I can overcome or transcend my sinfulness here and now in this lifetime. Does that help?
Do you think a person that is striving, each time they do a selfless act or they do something that is those things that striving people tend to focus on, do they always recognize their own sinfulness in the midst of doing those things?
Like I don't know how to answer that. I think as a backdrop, in the backdrop of their consciousness, is awareness of how frail and weak I am. I mean, as an isolated conscious moment, I don't know if they're aware of something faulty about their deed. They may not be.
I'm wondering if that's some kind of psychosis or if that's like a healthy spirituality.
To be aware.
Even when you do things that are good.
I don't know the answer. Sorry.
You are free.
Can you speak a little bit about how Paul is using the Bible, how he does exegesis, and how he uses it to make his points?
Well, I think we just need to let Paul do what it is he's doing. And in every different case, that may be slightly different. Let's take Deuteronomy, for example. If you ask, is he exegeting it, it's hard to answer that because on the one hand, well, yes, absolutely, he's exegeting it. On the other hand, what he has recorded here is not an exegesis of Deuteronomy 30. It's an application of it. But he's applying it after having, I think, exegeted very accurately and very carefully what it actually meant in the time that it was written to Israel as it came out of Moses' mouth. I think he understands that very well. But then what he's doing here in Romans is taking that passage and taking the essence of what it said and recognizing that that's applicable in a particular kind of way to his generation. Then what he does is he uses it what I would call rhetorically. That is, he creates his own rhetorical device using the language of Deuteronomy to make a point that was not the point of Deuteronomy, but it's a point that's true to the spirit of what Deuteronomy meant at that time. Thank you.